Good morning. My name is Vince Clausen. I'm one of the teachers here. I remember when I lost my mind. Does that make me crazy? I kind of think it does. Spirituality and religious beliefs really are kind of crazy when seen by people who don't share them, right? Yet these beliefs have power in our lives. For those of you who don't share these beliefs, you can see someone was doing bizarre things because of these beliefs. Speaking about a being we can't prove exists. Spending time and money in places you just don't even understand. And for those of you who have these beliefs, explaining yourself to people outside or people who have different beliefs, it's not easy. The whole thing kind of seems crazy. This whole series we've been talking, or taking an analogic look at the Easter story, focusing on different stories and different beliefs about Easter. But the story of the death of the character of Jesus called the Christ. Some of the stories don't fit with each other. Some of the stories don't fit within other parts of the Bible. But each of them have enough power to change us in a way that people outside look at us and say, that's crazy. And yet, this is the heart of the mystical view of spirituality, a view that can hold divergent views at the same time, a view that can have you believe something different than the person sitting next to you or in your seat right now, or at supper this afternoon, or at the pub. So are we crazy? I think a little bit we are. And that's a good thing. Because mystical spirituality will never fit the bounds of logic. It just doesn't. It'll never fit the limitations of organized religion. And yet it seems to make room for belief in a huge God. A God that could interact with you in a way that's totally unique for you, customized for you. Does that seem crazy? Or does that seem beautiful? Does that fit the heart of spirituality you want to be a part of? Because that's what I want. So with this mystic sense of spirituality in mind, we wanted to tell you parts of the Easter story. There are four main texts that the story comes from. They don't all agree on the details. So we're going to skate over a few parts. But for many of us, we haven't heard the whole story with all the difficulties in place. And yet it's been the foundation of our beliefs. This is the story that makes us crazy to our world. It's one of the foundational stories of Christianity. And it's the story of the death and resurrection of Jesus, called the Christ.
Well, good morning. I'm Jeff. And I don't know about you, but as an ardent follower of Jesus, I have to say that the events surrounding the final days of Jesus are extremely uncomfortable for me to imagine. How many ever saw the Passion for the Christ? Yeah, that was so uncomfortable for me to watch. I don't know about for you. Painful. I mean, it would be so much easier if Jesus was some kind of robot who felt no pain, who was unaffected by betrayal, emotional and physical abuse and torture. But the Jesus we read about in the Bible seemed far from bulletproof. He just seemed so human. The night before all hell broke loose, it seems anyways, that Jesus was aware that bad things were imminent. He was sitting down for a meal with his closest followers, and I'm betting that they could tell something was off with him. He's sitting there, and they're all kind of sitting down, and he says this. He says, someone around this table is going to betray me. You want to talk about awkward? Sitting around that table, having Jesus look at you and says, one of you is going to turn on me. I bet they were all sitting there trying, stumbling, wanting to assure him, it ain't me, Jesus. I would never do that. Can you imagine what that would have felt like, being one of them? What most people in that room didn't realize is that the betrayal had already begun. Judas, one of his disciples, had already agreed to hand Jesus over to some of the religious leaders who planned to kill him. The plan was already in the works. You wonder how hard it must have been for Jesus, sitting there looking in Judas's eyes as Judas is trying to calm him, calm his suspicion, saying, it's not me, Jesus. They ate together. Then they got up and they went for a big walk and led to the Mount of Olives. It was there that Peter took his turn, trying to assure Jesus, saying, I'm your man. I will never, ever betray you. Jesus looks him in the eyes and says, before the rooster crows in the morning, Peter, you will have denied even knowing me three times. Can you feel the angst in Jesus' words? All was not well with Jesus. They came to the Garden of Gethsemane. This is where Jesus' raw emotions, nerves begin to surface. Bible says Jesus stepped away from kind of the larger crowd or larger group of his followers into a more private moment with a few of them. And he opened up about the stress that he was under. He said to them, I am so deeply grieved right now to the point of dying. I don't even know what was running through their minds, but I'm sure they'd never seen Jesus like that. He just said, please stay here with me. And then in one of the most vulnerable moments, vulnerable human moments captured of Jesus, he begs God to alter the plan. He says, if it's possible, please God, take this cup of suffering from me. Abort the mission that you've asked me to fulfill. It's like he's saying, I know what you need to do, but I don't want to have to go through everything that it's going to require. At some point, he just musters up the courage to soldier up. And he says, not my will, but yours be done. Many have said of this Jesus, what a remarkable man. I mean, really, the mark that this man left on the world just seems so undeniable, doesn't it? The way he cared for people, and not just the important people, but the outcasts and the unlovables, the prostitutes, the lepers, the people no one wanted to touch. This guy ran to, it seemed. The people on the margins, defending the poor, offering forgiveness and second chances to those who had blown it, who had checkered paths. Right up to the very end, he was undeterred in doing and saying the things that he felt would help others, to the point where it cost him everything. Cost him his own life. Why? Why would he do that? The moral influence theory would say that he did this so that he could make his world better. So that he could show others a different way to live that would truly change the world. And in setting such an unselfish and heroic human example, he would inspire people for thousands of years. Even to this day, when we who have been influenced by this moral influence theory When we're asked what's Easter, this weekend, this celebration, why we're sitting here today, when we're asked what Easter means to us, a common thread seems to be about the climactic ending of one of the greatest examples that humanity has ever had to follow. Easter reminds many of us that his way of life, Jesus' way of life, has changed and is changing our world. And it inspires us. Easter and this experience inspires and challenges us to live our lives more and more like he did. You'll hear this in songs we sing. In fact, this song that we're going to sing, "You Have Called Me Higher," it's all about this. As the band sings, I'm going to invite you to sing as well. And as we do, may you and I be challenged to go higher and deeper and, like Jesus, be willing to do things sometimes we don't even want to do, but things that we believe will make a difference in our world. May this challenge be offered up in this song.
The garden story ended in the worst way possible. One of Jesus' students, Judas, for reasons we're not sure about, he brings the authorities to arrest Jesus. Conveniently away from all the crowds of people who love Jesus. In many readings, Judas comes up to Jesus and greets him with a kiss. Something he told the soldiers would be a sign of who Jesus was. He didn't have phones back in the days. You couldn't text someone a picture and be like, "Yeah, pick that guy up." So here's Jesus, and one of his students, his friends, gets up close enough to Jesus to kiss him, and by that betray him to death. In Luke's account, he has Jesus say to Judas, while he was still close enough to touch him, "Judas, you betray me with a kiss?" Here's someone Jesus poured his heart and his soul into. He taught him. He elevated him in society. He showed him a new way to live. And in the end, Judas betrays him. Betrayed by someone you love. The next scene has Jesus before the religious authorities, and it's a gong show. At least a faction of the group seems to be one to accuse Jesus of anything, really. They don't really care. There's another faction who seems to be wanting due process or justification for what they're going to do. I don't know what's going on. The testimonies against them are a joke, clearly made up. They don't agree. But most of the accounts focus on this question asked by the religious leader. Are you the Christ? For us 2,000 years later, it's an easy one. Of course he is. Jesus Christ, duh. It's his last name. But what the religious officials are asking is a lot more subtle than this. For them, it seems this is a much different idea. Much ink has been spilled over the expectations of what the Messiah was going to bring. But the Messiah, at least for some, seemed to have a savior sense. And since they were subjugated under Roman occupation, Jesus wasn't looking very saviorish in this moment. So when they ask, "Are you the Christ?" there seems to be a sense of, do you honestly think standing before us right now in our custody that you're going to save us from the Romans? Really? The Messiah could also have a sense of one tightly connected to God, like some of the great spiritual ancestors like Elijah or Moses. So when they say, "Are you the Christ?" it's almost like there's no answer. To say, "Yes, I am connected to God," jumps to, "But what about the whole Roman occupation thing?" And here's where there's some discrepancy in the accounts. In one account, Jesus says, "I am the Christ." In the rest of the accounts, he dodges the question. It's almost like he knows they won't believe him, so what's the point in poking the bear, right? But the reactions is the same in all accounts. "You are not the Messiah, and therefore you have blasphemed by saying you are." this point, at least a few suggested orders, things degrade. They start mocking Jesus, playing the junior high game of figure out who hit you. This, it seems, was the beginning of the physical violence towards Jesus. Like all great storytellers, the three of the accounts fold two stories together into one. Because during this interaction between Jesus and the religious officials, Jesus' best friend is there watching. His name's Peter, and he plays a huge role in the future of the church. In fact, in the Catholic tradition, the papal power comes from Peter. But he wasn't always a big shot. Because in this scene, he snuck into the courtyard where they're questioning Jesus after they've arrested him. Remember, no photo ID, so it's hard to keep the riffraff out. And I want to invite you to picture yourself in this scene. You're standing in the courtyard watching Jesus. Everyone around you wants to see him and any who are with him dead. If they find out who you are, you'll be next in line to die. You're in the lion's den. When someone asks you, aren't you one of Jesus' guys? And as you swear emphatically, I have no bloody clue what you're talking about. I've never even seen that guy. You hear a rooster crow. And you look over the shoulder of the person you're talking to. And you and Jesus lock eyes. And the look in his face, it's like a knife in your heart. The pain. Jesus said this was going to happen. We thought we were strong enough, right? We thought we'd have his back. We'd never disown him. We'd never betray him. And we just did. After all he did for us, we just slapped him across the face. All the accounts are unanimous in this. Peter broke down and wept over what he had done. And wouldn't you? The next scene has Jesus before the Romans because the religious officials who had arrested him couldn't kill him without Roman blessing. And the story starts to braid here, each account a little different than the next, but they all converge in one thing. The Roman ruler at the time, Pontius Pilate, says he's innocent of breaking our laws. But the crowd forms, and in one account, the religious officials rouse them to yell, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Like any good politician, Pilate tries a number of ways to pacify the crowd, save Jesus' life, but he even offers to release Jesus in his yearly Let's Be Nice to the Slaves initiative. But they'll have none of it. The text reads, "Crucify him. Crucify him." And so Pilate starts the long process to do what they asked, to kill Jesus. We don't really have many details from the authors about how Jesus died. They tell us it was on a cross. And from a later story, we realize that nails were used either on his hands or on his wrists. And the story tells of Jesus being hung between two thieves. One of which says, "Jesus, remember me when you enter your kingdom." Jesus replied, "Don't worry, I will. Today, you will join me in paradise." The author, John, after what we believe is an excruciating way to die, the author, John, has Jesus saying, "It is finished." And Jesus breathes his last. Substitutionary Atonement says there's a problem between God and humanity. It's called sin. It says that sin couldn't be dealt with by us because we just kept sinning. or we're sinful at our core. And so God, being full of a desire to connect with us, and yet not able to ignore sin, decides to take the penalty for sin on himself. And so he sends Jesus to die in our place, to take the punishment for our sins. The author John says it this way, "For God so loved the world, he gave his son." How does it feel to live like God loves us that much? That God would reach out for a relationship with us, with you. God would have grace for all of our faults and our issues, and forgive us for what we've done and for what we haven't done. The old school word for this is we are redeemed. We're perfect to God now. God so loved us that God would take whatever punishment we deserve. Each week we sing songs, and they come from different stories in the Bible, but the song we're going to sing now, I think, comes from this story in the Bible, of the story that God says, we are okay. We can hold our heads up high. God paid the price. We are redeemed. If you're open, sing it with us and reflect on what this story might mean to you.
Like a flickering candle, as Jesus breathed his last breath on the cross, it's like his followers' hopes for a better world to break out, it's like they just got snuffed out. Jesus had died. Imagine the disillusionment that Jesus' followers experienced as they watched Jesus, their mentor, their leader, mocked and beaten and exposed, and then dying. The sense of discouragement and defeat. This had not ended the way they had hoped or believed it would. Somehow it seemed evil had won. How could this be happening to Jesus? I can see them in those moments as it was all ending. Memories flooding back through their minds of the things he had taught them. The times when he said, hey, listen, there's tough times coming. I want you to remember this. And hey, I'm not going to be with you for long. But listen, this is what you need to do. And remember this. And don't forget that. I bet memories are just flooding through the times he helped. He intervened for people. He changed people's lives in a moment. Watching them run away with joy. The memories just flooding over them as they're watching it all end. How could this be? A man named Joseph of Arimathea received permission from Pilate to take Jesus' body down and to bury him in a tomb. He gets him to the tomb. He wraps him in this linen, it says. And then he rolls a large stone over the entrance and seals the tomb. If you read through the different accounts in the four Gospels of what happens over the next couple days, I got to be honest, you'll likely get a bit confused because there are different accounts of how it all happened. But probably the most common denominator from all the stories is that a few women came back to the tomb a couple days later. Who exactly the group is, it's hard to say. We know it's Mary. Well, it seems like Mary Magdalene for sure is there. But they came wanting to grieve. To mourn. Give him a burial he deserved. So they brought spices and they wanted to embalm him, and it was a whole ritual they're looking forward to doing, and they show up But when they arrive, he's not there. How exactly or what exactly went down isn't really clear. But according to the gospel accounts, what is clear is that Jesus' once dead body is no longer dead. He's gone, but he's alive. That's what comes out clear. Jesus is alive. Through the lens of the Christus Victor theory, we've talked about, it was at this moment when Jesus' body went from dead to living. It was at that very moment when God beat death, that everything in our world changed cosmically. Here they thought that evil had won out, that death had ultimate power over good, that all hope had been lost. But Jesus wasn't gone. According to the story, he wasn't dead, but he was very much alive. For those who have been impacted by this explanation, this perspective of the Easter story, this story of Easter is filled with hope. Because when life seems to have fallen apart, when the water levels rise, and I've talked to a few this morning who know what I'm talking about, when the waves seem to start crashing in all around you, your marriage, your health, your life, and it seems in some way that hope is draining out of the system. Evil maybe seems to be winning. Christus Victor, in this vision of the Easter story, reminds us, God wins in the end. Death and evil don't have the final say, but there is hope in the midst of the discouragement and what may seem like defeat. Well, we've just shared three different perspectives of the Easter story, different things that we've taken away over the centuries from this event, this cataclysmic event. The question I got to ask you this morning is, what does Easter mean to you today? What does it mean to you? What do you walk away with today? What is your heart and your thoughts and your soul resonating around? Perhaps some of you this morning see Easter as a compelling reminder of the power of a life lived for others. For you, perhaps Easter offers one of the most vivid challenges to live the way Jesus lived more and more. The story and the example of Jesus' life, perhaps for you, grips you and says, I can live more like this guy. I can follow the things that he talked about better. This guy who changed so much in his world and in mine. I can do this. Maybe for others, Easter for you is about new beginnings. That through remembering Jesus' death, you believe you've been granted a new start. You have a past, but you believe because of Easter, you can leave your past behind and you can start fresh. That by him taking the hit for you or for someone you know, your life is now new again. You got another chance to live right, to make things right, to be better, to do better, to love, to accept, to give back in some way. Easter for you is about a new start and a new way of being. And yet I'm betting there's probably others here today who for you Easter is a message of hope. That no matter how dark the clouds roll in, how dark life might seem, even right now. No matter how deep the waters are, or how strong the waves feel like they're crashing in around you in any chapter of your life. For you, Easter is a reminder of the hope. Because evil hasn't won. In the end, it's God who will win. Though Jesus died, he didn't stay dead. Hope wasn't lost. Hope was found.
Regardless of what you take away with today, maybe it's a new story, maybe it's an old story, maybe it's three stories that don't fit together that well. May the Easter story change something inside of you. May it inspire you to live in a new way or with a new reality. And may it fill you with the glory of the Lord.
Thank you. You may be seated for just a second. We're about to... Yeah, you can give him a hand. That's allowed. That's a good thing. My name is Grant, and this is the time we call DFW. I've been coming to Friends Church for almost 14 years, and one reason why I always come back and why I love it was like today. I've heard the Easter message many times, but I think today I got something even more out of it, and that's what Friends Church does, and it even tells us, it challenges us. What did we get out of it? We can't just sit back here today and take in a nice feeling. It challenges us when we leave here today, and that's why I always come back to Friends Church, and we always like doing something a little bit different on occasion like today, because it's DFW. If you're visiting, it's what we call donating financial water. It's our offering. Usually the First Impressions team comes down and they hand out the baskets. We're not doing that today. As you leave, we ask you to give your donation, your financial water, in the basket. Christina and Lois are at the doors as you leave, so please put your donation in the basket. If you need a pen or an envelope, they're at the table just before the door. So if you need an envelope to put your money in for tax receipt purposes, you can do that. Okay? It's a little bit different. Might be a little congested, but be patient. And if you want to donate online, I guess we don't have it on the screen, you can use your phone right now and go to friendschurch.ca, the website, and look for the donate, and you can go right there and do it immediately if you don't have cash on you today. Okay? Enjoy the day. You can leave whenever you want, but I'm going to ask the band, Amanda and the band, weren't they great today? Yes. To play one more song. Happy Easter, everybody.